There's absolute pandemonium in the Robin Golf Sweepstakes with 1 week left to play. 7 or 8 of you could legitimately take it all. There is more literal death at a PGA event for the second week in a row. Plus, Sportico's Evanovi Williams helps us make sense of all the new money that'll be flying all over the place out in the open in college sports. This is Robin Pod. Welcome inside. 7 weeks in the books, one to go for the competition that is top of mind. We came into the week with a ton of parity. The top 8 contestants were separated by about 100 points from one another in order. I don't mean collectively, I mean one by one. You had Rybletowski in first, Hogan in second, Garin in third, Davis in fourth, Leary in fifth. We're going 2,400, 2,300, 2,200, etc. down the standings. It looked like a ladder as the numbers decreased. Well, now the picture's a lot muddier because we had complete chaos courtesy of the Charles Schwab Challenge, which sounds like trying to withdraw your money from an account that you just can't quite remember the login to. We have guys like Merck, Emig, Moskowitz, DJ Leary. They're in the top 10. They come out this week. They put up 500 plus points each. You think, okay, we got movers. Then Better Hair Than Mark Davis comes along, and the bald freak puts up 650. That's a record for 1 week. Catapults him into second place. Should have been first. We'll talk about that. Aggressive. Then last week's guest, the COO, Jake Williams, puts up 750 points. You're thinking, how is this even mathematically possible? Then you see that he stayed in place in the standings. Went from 7th to 7th, then you're really thinking, how is this possible? Well, it's in part because the Blue Emu, Joe Emig himself, who we called in the first post of the year, the Rich Beam of the Robin Golf Sweepstakes. He flaps his wings. He flies in off a stage left. He puts up 850 points. He wins every possible market on the card, except the Pick 2 outright winner market, which nobody won. Because it wasn't possible to win. It was not HQ's banner week. I'm going to go through the markets here really quickly. We had Make the Cut Parlay. This was free money. This is where you pick two people to make the cut. They both have to do it. You already know what these are by now. You've been doing this for 7 weeks. Free money. Everyone won except Leave a Message at the Tone and the Ranger of the North. 16 out of 18 of you won. Cut moved down to +2 on Friday. It was projected to +1. It therefore met and captured Maverick McNeely, fantastic name, Aaron Rye, Lee Hodges, all available selections in the Make the Cut Parlay markets and all winners. Who did it better? Who did it worse? Market. One of my personal favorites is where you're picking a golfer to finish either above or below a certain position in the standings. Again, free points. Everyone but Josh Pearl and Professor Z won. Again, 16 out of 18 of you. Shout out to Aragorn this time, who faded Max Homa. And my God, do we have a lot to say about Max Homa before we get to Evanovi Williams coming up after the first break. Aragorn won his market Friday night when Homa didn't make the cut, but oh, Homa did so much more. Daniel Berger finished better than 48th, thanks to a last hole birdie that got him tied for 45 on Sunday. Also, shout out Chad Guerin. Decent week, but not great, thanks to everybody else. He faded Alejandro Kirk. Nope, that's the catcher for the Blue Jays. Chris Kirk? Who the hell's Kirk? I put him on the card. Again, not a banner week for HQ. Anyway, he faded somebody with the last name Kirk, who also missed the cut. So congrats to Chad Guerin. He was a winner there. On to the more important markets. T20 to win, pick two. This is when you pick two separate golfers to make the top 20. Pretty straightforward, not a parlay. This also felt like free points. Harris English and Putnam, they didn't make the cut of the tournament. Those were two selections. Hogan lost both of her top 20s. Denny McCarthy, which she picked, finished one stroke outside T20 because he shot a birdie-free round on Sunday. Evan Davis, one of the biggest winners of the week, he won on Sungjae. He pretty much pegged everything to Sungjae this week, and that was a nice selection. Guerin got both of his with Finau and Straka. Finau was outstanding all week. Then he shot 5 over on Sunday, dropped him to T18th. He was just one stroke inside the top 20 markets. So a lot of nail biting there for some people. Merck, Williams, Emig, Aragon, Brown, Guerin, all winning on Tony, who if he had dropped one more shot, wouldn't have been as good of a day. The guy from South Africa, whose last name looks like Gesundheit, I think it's Bezuidenhout. We'll just pretend that that's what it is. Be easy, and you fill in the rest. He finished one stroke above 20th place thanks to a final hole birdie, winning a nice 100 points for Leave a Message at the Tone. Harmon, Horschel, and McCarthy, and Minwoo Lee all finish one stroke outside of the top 20, one of the many crushing misses of the week for Hogan. Absolutely brutal week for Hogan, who was second coming into this week, and boy, it was not the week to not catch up. Head-to-head matchup, parlay market. This is where Evan Davis and many others really made some of their money this weekend. All chances, I believe, were 115 points. This is where you've got to pick player A to beat player B and player C to beat player D. A and C both have to win in order for your selection to win. You also got to select two pairings. So really, you picked A over B, C over D, and then you did it again with other players. So you had two chances to have two guys both win. Davis won both of his chances. That's 230 of his massive 650-point week. But so too did number five, DJ Leary. And so too did number six, Tim Merck. And so too did number seven, Jake Williams. And so too did number eight, Joe Emig. Leader Matt Roblitowski got one of his two picks, so he got 115 of the 230 available. Number two, Sarah Hogan, lost both. And number three, Guerin, lost both. Guerin was particularly tragic here because he needed to keep pace, and he kind of did but kind of didn't. I believe he still sits in third. We'll get to the final standings at the end of this. He pinned both his tails to the wrong donkey because one leg of both of his H2H matchup parlay selections was Minwoo Lee to defeat Sungjae Im. This was not the week to fade Sungjae Im. Sungjae shot the round of Friday, a 64. He was top five going into the weekend. When you factored in Minwoo's disastrous Sunday, I believe he was five over, didn't stand a chance. Speaking of Sungjae Im, he ran away with the Korean nationality market this week. We had the five Korean golfers. Many people selected Sungjae, heavy favorite, only worth 65 points. It helped many people. Multi-chance to win the tournament market. Here's where it gets stinky. What is this market? It's where you pick a group of four players and one of them has to win the tournament. That's it. You get two chances. So in total, you pick eight players, two groups of four. And we took 40 most favored to win, and we grouped them into buckets of four. And you got to pick two buckets, and the winner, X Scotty, so if Scotty wins, the guy that finishes second, has to be among the eight people that you select. Davis Riley was not available. Here's where we went wrong. One of the first places we went wrong this weekend. You got to put in field. You got to account for the other 124 people out there. They probably won't win. Well, they did. And one of those 124 was Davis Riley. Didn't really feel like calculating the points you'd win if you picked field and field won. It's a lot of data points. Tough calc. But should have had field. Our bad. As a result, all of you enthusiastically picked your groups of four. Davis Riley was not in any of them. So none of you won that market. A few of you picked Keegan Bradley, who was on a card. He finished second. Scottie Scheffler, by the way, shot one over on Sunday and finished tied for second. Keegan Bradley should have finished second outright. You know who the only two people who chose Keegan Bradley were? Guerin and Hogan. The two who, again, suffered a relatively heartbreaking day compared to the rest of the top 10 contestants, particularly Hogan, really, really struggled out there. Gotta put field in it. Really like field's chances this year. The story of the week, though, was the top 40 parlay fiasco. And it's the reason why our leader is still our leader by the slimmest of margins. Well, no. Sorry. Check that. The story of the week was that Grayson Murray died. We had death again on the PGA Tour. Grayson was a player. He was 30 years old. He was playing in the first two rounds of the tournament. He was playing with Peter Malnati on Friday. He got to 16. He made a putt, had two holes to go. He was right at the cut line. He said, "I'm withdrawing. I'm out. Don't feel good." Hours later, he was dead. I've never heard Jim Nantz on the broadcast shift his voice down to first gear so severely. He read an outro going to break that was like 2.5 minutes long as he was stretching every word like 15 seconds. That was the story of the tournament. The story of our weekend, though, the top 40 parlay fiasco. The top 40 parlay market is where you pick two players and they both have to make the top 40 after Sunday. And if they both do, you win points. If one of them does not, you lose. If both do not, you lose. If one of them misses the cut, you definitely lose. When we wrote the card, the wrong keys were stroked. The market headline said top 40 parlay. The description of the market said both players have to shoot a bogey-free round. That makes no sense. That was obviously an error. It was meant to just be the top 40 parlay market. Made a little correction at HQ, took the mea culpa, fell on the sword, and basically we said, hey, guys, if either of those scenarios work out, bogey-free round parlay is highly unlikely, so whatever. But if both of those scenarios work out, then perfect, you win. So either your two selections can get top 40, or if your two selections also both shoot a bogey-free round, you'll win. 1 through 9, except Evan Davis, all made at least one of their two selections as Max Homa, the villain of the week. Totally forgotten about, didn't even make the cut. Now, Max couldn't have had a bogey-free round, right? Or finished top 40, because he didn't make the cut, as I just said. He had shot 7 over by Friday. So, obviously, there was no way that Homa made either of these things. This is important because if 1 through 9 all selected a top 40 parlay that at least had Homa as one of the two, well, then they were all going to lose because Homa didn't make either of those things, even with our mea culpa, even with giving people a second chance to win, right? On top of that, dear leader Rob Letowski, he made both of his top 40 market parlay selections to include Homa. So, I mean, by Friday, it was like, well, shit, the leaders, I mean, he's going to lose both of these. People can gain ground, right? The tournament's in turmoil. Wrong. 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 Max Homa, somehow, I have never seen this before, shot 7 over in the first 2 rounds, definitionally finished worse than 40th. Like, way, way worse. They don't even number him when you get that low. He would have been the equivalent of, like, 90th. But yet he somehow did actually have a bogey-free round. On Friday. That's how bad his Thursday was. I've never seen someone 5 strokes off the cut line have a bogey-free round one of their first 2 rounds. Absolutely unreal. Even more so because the person who did it was Homa himself, who is volatile even when he's playing really well. He is the last person, by the way, I would ever pick in a bogey-free market. Even though you weren't all picking that, you were picking top 40, but I screwed it up. So because Rob Letowski and pretty much all the rest of 1 through 10 picked Homa, and because Homa pulled a bogey-free round out of his ass despite shooting 7 over, and because HQ effed up the market description and decided to fall on their sword and honor both things that the card said, because of all of these very unlikely things, all of 1 through 9 now can actually still win this market. So whoever they picked opposite Homa as the second leg of their parlay, they just need to shoot a bogey-free round, and they win. Fascinating. There were 5 pairing options with Homa on the card. This was an odd sort of pegged choosing we did this time. Not sure if we'll do it again for the RBC next week. But you had 15 pre-made parlays you could select. 5 of them had Morikawa and one other golfer. 5 had Jordan Spieth and one other golfer, and 5 had Max Homa and one other golfer. Homa's others were as follows. Big shot Bobby McIntyre. He did not have a bogey-free round. He had one even par round with two bogeys, missed the cut. Chris Goddard did not have a bogey-free round. He had one even par round with two bogeys and missed the cut. Luke List did not have a bogey-free round. He had one even par round with two bogeys and he missed the cut. Weird, right? Patrick Rogers and Lee Hodges were the final two. Will they bail? And I mean absolutely Christmas morning bail any of these home selectors out? Rogers comes out Friday. He shoots a 367. Ooh, there's potential. But he bogeyed the third. This leaves only Lee Hodges. Lee Hodges was ho-hum in the initial rounds. And then he comes out on moving day and he scorches it. 4 under 66. Clean card. Who did leader Matt Rablatowski happen to have picked next to Max Homa? Lee Hodges. Rablatowski wins 100 points on a technicality screw-up from HQ and the most unlikely possible scenario of honoring our own error. Joe Emig and Jake Williams also were among those who picked Homa and Hodges. They also benefited. But it's Rablatowski I want to focus on for the interim, because let's go down our new standings through week 7, 1 week left to play. The RBC Canadian next week. After that, we will determine the winner of the $1,000 2024 Robin Golf Sweepstakes Grand Prize. And it is a crowded leaderboard. Matt Rablatowski, 2,799 points. Second place, Evan Davis, 2,770 points. Third, Chad Guerin, 2,670. Fourth, DJ Leary, 2,569. Fifth, Sarah Hogan, 2,555. Emig, Williams, and Merck are within 100 of the top five as well. Rablatowski doesn't win those 100 points. He is in second, and Davis is in first. Does this come into play in our final week? We will have to wait and see. We're going to chat with Eben Novi Williams in just a second, but first, a quick word. We are officially less than 3 months away from the tournament that started it all, the Robin College Football Sweepstakes. The $2,500 grand prize for the top finisher at the end of the season is back, but we're also giving away smaller weekly prizes for the top points getter for each week. We're ditching Google Forms, we're moving things over to Typeform for a better entry experience, but most importantly, if you want to enter, subscribe to Robin's college football content. It's the easiest way to do it. Subscriptions don't just get you access to the tournament. They get you access to all the college football posts on Robin, including our summer game preview series, the Robin Crystal Ball, plus recap posts, the standings, the nicknames, and everything else you love. And for a limited time, we are taking $10 off that subscription. Go to robinsports.com/earlybird to take advantage of this offer before August 1st. That's robinsports.com/earlybird for $10 off the full season subscription. He is a former child golf prodigy and a lifelong bon vivant, doing things like swimming al fresco in the Hudson Valley, which we will hear about, like last week's guest, Jake Williams, with whom he shares a last name but no relation. He is someone too successful to not be trapped in New York, yet is exhaustively on record about craving life someday in the Northwest, right around here where I sit at HQ. He manages to work in media successfully, to be paid a living wage, which already that's a 15-to-1 parlay, and to break countless stories, all while not being a douche. He might be Sportico's deputy editor, but I will stand for nothing short of editor-in-chief. My compass of the ever-changing sports landscape He is known in the Robinverse as the Innovator. Ladies and gentlemen, Eben Novi Williams joins the pod.
What Hello, an Eben. Intro, Will. I wish half of those things were true. Jake Williams and I are not related. That one you nailed. Everything else I'm a little more suspect about, but I appreciate it, my friend.
It's like how I took tests in college. you're right on 20%, but the other 80 was creative.
But I'm going to take it verbatim and put it as my LinkedIn profile as soon as we're done with the pod.
I want the people to know that it's Eben with a B if they're scoring at home. That's B as in, boy, this paying college athletes thing got out of hand really fast. I wonder who could have seen that coming. That sort of B. Eben was also a child golf prodigy. And I wanted the people to know that.
I've been trying to tell you, Will, as you know, that having a young child is the perfect time to start a big golf habit. Just Saturday, Sunday morning tee times. I recommend it.
I ran that by Mrs. Robin, and it was met with, I can't say those words on the air. Before we sort of get into a lot of the stories that we're going to be discussing today, which is more around college sports and all of the developments there, any takes on what's going on with PGA Live, the never-ending drama, the resignation of board members? What are you hearing from your perch atop media's ivory tower?
I think it's such a fascinating topic. And I think for a long time I was looking, and I think a lot of people did, look at Live versus PGA as some kind of binary outcome, as one was doing better and stronger from a leverage standpoint in their merger, the other one was going to be slipping. I think everybody's losing is the answer. And I think maybe golf, professional golf as a global entity, is maybe the biggest loser at this point. But the longer we go on without a deal being struck, the more both sides are very clearly trying to leverage up during the negotiations. Live signed John Rahm, the PGA Tour onboarded $1.5 billion from a group of very powerful American sports team owners. The more they talk about merger, but are simultaneously very much still fighting the same fight they were fighting before they decided to come together. I think that the deal gets worse and worse, and golf in this weird middle interim is, I think, a less powerful, less commercialized, and less interesting product for the fans and the players.
What is behind the jockeying for power on the PGA board side of things, the tour policy committees? It seems like PGA is out leveraged to begin with, and now there's internecine fighting over who really has the say as to who steers the PGA. It seems like trouble on top of trouble.
I wish I knew all of the details about why people were leaving, and I'll be honest, I don't. The PGA entered this with a number of fairly nice cards, right? They still had Tiger and Rory, and that was valuable. They had access to tournaments and ranking points, something that was very valuable to Live and valuable to the golfers that Live signed. The PGA brand, at least right now, is significantly stronger than the Live brand is. And the biggest disadvantage they had, Will, was money. And I'll be honest, they haven't closed that gap by any means, but adding $1+ billion in excess capital really, really helps. I think what PGA is doing is trying to strengthen the cards it has at the table, to use a bad metaphor, in hopes that when they do strike a deal, there's a little bit better on the term side.
Adding $1.5 billion in capital for a professional, I don't want to say league, but more association, right, was seen as a significant step, a perhaps unorthodox step. You don't hear about, the NBA is seeking $3 billion in new funding. And now we are seeing that in the collegiate landscape.
Good transition.
Did you like that?
Very nice.
That's called a segue. I've learned about that in the business. But just to erase my own good work, I want to talk about the absolute biggest business story of the week, and that, of course, is the Shrimpgate, the bankruptcy of Red Lobster restaurant chains. We couldn't go another minute without first speaking to this. Eben, your thoughts on Red Lobster?
My first thought is that I've been preparing my whole life to talk about Red Lobster. I don't know.
Tuck in your bib, Eben.
Oh, exactly. I've tied on the little lobster bib. I don't know if you grew up with Red Lobster or going often. I think this story, I love this story because I think it has something for everybody business-wise. If you know nothing about business, you can understand why offering unlimited shrimp for $20 is potentially a very bad business decision. If you know a little bit about business, you can certainly understand why if your seafood restaurant chain is owned by a huge seafood distributor company, that using the restaurant chain to order above market prices from the owner seafood distributor is probably a recipe for failure. And then if you're a business head, really, real quick, just to finish, if you're a business head, you understand why the lecherous relationship between private equity and new industries like fast casual restaurants is potentially a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, no, it's a tiramisu cake of I want to hit on the middle portion of what you discussed, because all the headlines say the endless shrimp promotion, which even as not a Red Lobster acolyte, I was aware of the endless shrimp promotion took them under. That is apparently mathematically not true. It cost them around $11 million. Whereas part three, the lecherousness, the just out and out, we're going to rot your corpse and leave you for dead while we've taken what's in your pockets, cost them around $1.5 billion. They should talk to the PGA in bad leaseback terms. But I want to talk about point two. This, to me, is the most undercovered element of this, and that is that they were apparently, in addition to being the chew toy of private equity, they also somehow were a waste disposal bin for this company, Thai Union's excess shrimp. It's less than good shrimp. Now, let's be clear. I have no personal Red Lobster experience. I've already said that, but I've driven past the signs.
You've missed out, my friend, and maybe forever, unfortunately.
I've missed out on more than just the experience. It sounds like I've missed out on some grade F shrimp, because I want to read this to you. This is from the Los Angeles Times. One had no experience running a restaurant chain, didn't notice the signs that it was heading towards a fiasco, and may not have cared as long as it could keep pumping its shrimp into the chain's pipeline. Basically saying that this company, Thai Union, which was one of several owners of Red Lobster at the time, had all of this shrimp, you know, as the Thais do. They just load it up, they put it in bags, and then they send it to Costco. And it's really just not, it's not great shrimp, right? There's a lot of you know, there's
sure
the nitrites or something, you know, there's a lot of stuff. I just want to focus on this issue very briefly of Red Lobster, after being just completely over-leveraged, put in a horrific financial situation, was also the waste bin for this company to deposit and profit off of, like, the worst dregs of its product.
Should Robin get into to below average quality shrimp at above market prices? Is that what do you think as the business strategy?
There's a seafood angle. There's a seafood angle for sure. Thai Union came in and they eliminated two other suppliers of breaded shrimp, giving them an exclusive deal that led to higher costs to Red Lobster. Why? I mean, if you can own a company and then also separately sell a product that you mandate that the company that you own has to buy, I mean, you know, it's not unheard of, but it's pretty crafty.
Yeah, there's some people listening to this that are nodding and being like, these guys are geniuses.
But this is really a parallel with the PGA story that we've taken far too long to get past at this point, and that is that, again, everyone lost.
I was going to say, the one winner, and Thai Union, who knows? Red Lobster is not a huge part of their business, obviously, and they can write it down, and they've been in trouble for other things, including the way workers are treated in other markets, not the U.S., but unfortunately, the loser is me, who doesn't get to get $20 endless shrimp anymore. That's the
loser is me. Strong contender for title of the podcast.
The metaphor that people use is, you don't want to see the sausage get made. I don't think you want to see the tuna get canned or the shrimp get packaged either.
There's one element though where I do really want to see the tuna get canned, and this is involving a story that you've worked on. I want to see the tuna get canned as it pertains to private equity, not raping and pillaging fast casual seafood, but private equity possibly doing the same to college sports. You wrote a piece this past week. Segue. You wrote another piece this past week about Redbird and Weatherford, which are two VC firms who are planning. You actually broke the story, by the way. You had the exclusive. I should have given you proper props. Redbird and Weatherford, two VC firms investing up to $2 billion in college athletic departments via a fund called Collegiate athletic solutions. When first read, this sort of seems like investing, then it sort of seems like lending, then it kind of seems like neither. Break this down for us.
I think lending is maybe certainly the way that they would like you to look at it. I think to take a step back for a second, college sports going through a ton of upheaval, as you know, I think a lot of the listeners are going to understand as well. And we can get into as much or as little of that as you want. But it is the perfect market for institutional capital. And I don't mean that to make it sound like it's a good thing. But if you look right now at college sports, they're tremendously undervalued and under-monetized brands. They have a worker base, and I don't mean this to sound mean, I mean this to be honest, is not an incredibly savvy worker and executive base. They are all scared that they don't have enough money and are desperately seeking capital. And then from a business standpoint, it's a truly national market in a number of sports areas like the South and the Midwest, where there's not a ton of professional sports teams. There's scarcity value. We're not minting new huge college sports or college football brands at this point. It's similar to the NBA and the NFL. And it's uncorrelated from the market. So one of the things a lot of private capital investors want is they want to make sure that they're diversifying their portfolio. And you can own Red Lobster and you can own a pharmaceutical giant that has locations around the world or country, and they don't feel like they're correlated. But the minute that commercial real estate soars through the roof, suddenly both those assets are screwed. What sports offers and what college sports offers is potentially a fairly big investment that you can make that is largely uncorrelated from a lot of the rest of your investments. And that's really attractive also. So for all these reasons kind of coming together in one big salad of potential exploitation, I think that a lot of smart and savvy investors on the private capital, private credit, private equity, however you want to phrase it, are all looking at college sports and, you know, the money symbols in the eyes. They're just like Googling in and out as they look at an industry that is about to make a lot more money and that they can get involved with pretty quickly.
And an industry that's going through a severe amount of turbulence, right? Real end in sight, yeah. which we'll also get to on the back half when we talk about an additional story with some of the class action suits with the NCAA. But to be clear, this fund is not investing or taking a literal ownership stake in a program. They are more looking for a cut of future realized revenue.
That's right. I wouldn't be shocked if we eventually figure out a way to do equity. And the way that's typically happening in other places is you create a holding company that holds all your commercial assets.
Sure.
And instead of giving a private equity company 10% of Michigan football, you give them 10% of Michigan Enterprises, Inc. or whatever that holds all the commercial assets.
Connor Stallions, Vacuum Cleaners Repairman.com, LLC. Yeah,
exactly. Doing business as Wolverine's Business, Inc. But this group, specifically this Redbird and Weatherford group, is looking to do exactly what you said, to provide money up front in exchange, not for a contractually obligated piece of revenue in the future, but for a shared piece of additional revenue that they're generating. And again, if you believe, like a lot of people do, that all of these teams, at least the big ones, are going to be making more money in the future than they are now, it's a pretty safe bet that if you're getting a big chunk of the additional revenue, that there's a way to be made whole there. I mean, the thing that I think gets lost in a lot of places is if you're an athletic director of Spokane U and you want $200 million, there's a few ways you can get it, right? You can just go to a bank, theoretically. You can try the municipal bond route. You can beg your donors. This is why the Wildcats need $200 million.
The Spokane U Wildcats?
What are they? The Timbers? Well, you tell me.
That's not a school. It doesn't exist. I don't know what to say.
Either way, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And private capital is one of the more expensive ways. And the pitch that is going to be made is that a lot of these companies are going to provide operational expertise to help Spokane U navigate this new world of paying its football players and paying its college basketball players and professionalizing a lot of the sponsorship sales, et cetera. And that's, I think, the question that's going to hit a lot of athletic directors is there's other ways to get money. But is this more expensive version of it the right one for your school, your football team, and your athletic department?
There are Florida State University fingerprints all over this. We know how tribal college sports is. Yeah. We know how distrusting one fan base is of another, all of that, right? Does the fact that this initiative, oh, it's Redbird Capital. Well, actually, it's Redbird and Weatherford. Oh, what's Weatherford? Oh, that's Drew Weatherford. Who's that? He played for Florida State and he's on their board. Actually, he's resigning, but there could be some conflict. Probably not because he's resigning.
He's not resigning. He's recusing himself. Yeah, he's going to stay on the board.
Recusing. Yeah. I should say recusing from any conflict. Perhaps I'm totally overemphasizing this, but how much does that play a role at all in people's or certain schools' willingness to sign up for this?
It's a good question. I think the answer is that it's not going to play that big a role. I mean, the NFL and NBA are obviously extremely competitive, and there are number of funds that are invested in multiple NBA teams and multiple NHL teams. So there is a way at least to keep some kind of a wall around proprietary information or data or all those things.
I'm just envisioning a scenario in which an FSU-backed fund somehow does a deal with Florida, and then Florida leveraged some of that money instead of providing for things like NIL to pay the legal fees associated with Billy Napier's lawsuit as brought by Jalen Rashada. Speaking of Jalen Rashada,
the segues here, Will, are just on point.
Yeah, well, you know, Evan, I'm a professional. I've done this twice. here is my one of several fundamental issues. We don't know what the money is for. We know what it's for broadly. Of course, we all do, right? It's to compete in this new landscape, right? But specifically, we don't know what, if any, guardrails there will be around this. And with this story and the story we'll talk about next, we get further and further and further away from one of the oldest. You've had this offensive lineman who's wrecked his body for 6 years from 2016 to 2022, and he's been compensated in zero way, even though he played for insert major program and helped earn the school X amount of money. We're getting further and further and further away from that and more towards how can we pay a high schooler, you know, $8 million in a bag discreetly and outbid other schools to do that when that high schooler has earned us nothing to date, right? There's no labor that the five-star recruit has put in to earn a college money. So we're getting away, obviously, from the inherent intent. Am I making this too simple, right? Is money going to CapEx? Is money going to other forms of investment that are going to broaden programs? Or is this really about the brown paper bag that goes to whoever we need to attract?
I think that the one thing I'll say about where we are right now, this is just such a specific weird middle ground in athlete compensation where we know what the future holds. We're not there yet. We know what the past was. We're also not there anymore. And we're now in this weird middle ground where NIL money is disguised as many, or they package it as many different things, and it's promised in weird ways. And athletes like Jalen Rashada are getting promised things that they don't get, which was happening for the past few decades in college sports. We just never heard about it because he wasn't technically allowed to get the money in the first place, and therefore his options for legal recourse were pretty minor. I think this is a perfect, this story and many's like it are a perfect example of why where we are right now is unsustainable. And everybody seems to agree with that. Even people who very much disagree with what it should look like on the back end, this weird middle ground where someone like Jalen Rashada gets paid not for playing at any of these schools, but essentially for committing to and wanting to play for any of these schools, and how that affects deliverables and all that. I think all that goes away in the near future in big time college football when schools are more able to directly compensate their biggest stars.
We've got the compensation money coming, whether or not we think that's sufficient. And again, that refers to what's going on with the class action suits. Is it not reasonable to think then that this VC money that's coming in, totally separate, unrelated to the class action stuff, is much more about winning recruits, the bidding war for talent?
I think it's everything, I think. Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned CapEx earlier. Yeah, there's going to be a stadium revolution in college football. You've been to maybe even more college football stadiums than I have. The ones I've been to are, if you look at it from a commercial lens, are horrifying, right? They're 110,000 seats that are just bleachers. And then there's a lot of them don't have don't have luxury boxes or suites, nothing like we see in the pros. The reason, if you look at the college basketball teams, the money that they make, the reason Louisville is consistently in the top two or three is because they play in an NBA arena.
The KFC Yum Center.
The Yum Center. Yes. Yeah, yeah. They wanted an NBA team. They built an NBA arena. Louisville did not get an NBA team. Louisville basketball, university basketball, got to use, with favorable terms, an NBA arena. And there's not many basketball teams that play in those settings. There's going to be a facilities revolution. I think, yeah, it's going to go to athletes for sure. It's going to go to coaches. There's this feeling out there that in the new world, there's not going to be enough money for big time coaches. I could not disagree more with that. I think in some ways the arms race is going to extend even more so to big time coaches, especially as the compensation, the ability of schools to compensate them gets bigger. I think you're going to see even more, the biggest football coaches command even bigger salaries.
My initial gut reaction is to think like it's 2017 and to think that there's 128 FBS schools and they're all competing theoretically for the same prize. And so therefore, wow, wouldn't this be great if CAS could somehow find a way to partner with those schools most in need, right? Still taking all the principles of venture capitalism, right? But applying it to those that want to level up to try to compete more. But of course, that's not what this is about. And we also know that there's not going to be a 120, now it's, I believe, 134 football bowl subdivision, probably much, much longer anyway. So of course, it's not about that. But can you imagine if this money, Sportico's database, by the way, which I think is really interesting, has revenue generated per sport, per school. And I think you're missing about 20 of those schools in there.
The private ones. We have all the public ones. Yeah.
Florida International, North Texas, Northern Illinois, Ball State, and Georgia State were the five schools that earned the least, generated, I shouldn't say earned the least, generated the smallest amount of revenue from college football in the 2022-23 season, between 2 and 3 million.
Which is a shockingly low number, by the way. It's a shockingly low number.
I don't know how it's that low, but I trust the data you've gathered, yeah. Right? For comparison, Texas generated $182 million in that time span, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. It generated roughly 17 times the amount of the five lowest schools combined. So there's also an obvious inequity in this. While money is infiltrating college athletics to, at least on the athlete side, try to promote some vague overarching patina of equity. And yet in this sphere where we have folks like CAS now intending to come in, isn't this really just a tool for the haves to have more?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The private equity is not looking at South Alabama and thinking, we could turn this around. They're looking at schools like Florida State and Clemson, which are not in the right conferences, but have had tremendous success and have huge fan bases and have really valuable brands. Not to say that there aren't going to be deals lower down in the food chain, but you're putting your finger on what I think is one of the two great lies of modern college sports. And that was that the idea that Alabama and South Alabama and Southeastern Alabama Tech are all peers that need to compete under the same set of rules. And the NCAA tried that for decades, and it's literally the thing that broke the NCAA and college sports, was its adherence to this idea that all these schools are equal. It is a fundamental lie, and the heads were in the sand for too long trying to keep these things together. And you're right. All the upheaval we're seeing right now is, I think, one of the things it's going to do is finally lay waste to that idea that there aren't 25 schools that are playing a different game financially and essentially on the field as well from everybody else. Maybe it's not 25, maybe it's more like 35, 40 or 50, something in that range. And it's fully going to separate, and we'll see schools that try to play the game of keeping up. And a lot of them are going to fail, just like we've seen schools try and fail to keep up in the last few years. But all of that's going to get extended out in the near future.
It is a business above all else, and it is a business that's fracturing. I think instead of distinguishing the haves from the have-nots, it seems like we're turning even more from distinguishing the haves from the lesser haves at this point, as we do tiers on top of tiers, right? Power Five conferences turning into Power Two, and where do the remaining 2.5 RIP Pac-12, where do those go? It all reminds me of the Pete Thamel quote from an article that he had back in January. He was quoting somebody from the venture capital community, and the anonymous source basically told Thamel, what are you looking for if you're private equity? You're looking for a poorly managed business that nevertheless has a strong market. That's the definition of college athletics.
Ding, ding, ding.
You know what else is a poorly managed business? Red Lobster. Robin Pod is not brought to you by Wendy's. You know, inflation is still on the rise and times are tough, but Wendy's is here to help. You've probably heard about our 50 nuggets for $15 promotion, you know, where you feed your whole family with something that several months ago resembled poultry but is now a chemical-filled paste that slowly kills you from the inside. Well, now we're introducing Wendy's newest value menu item, 27 hamburgers for just $5. That's right, $5. That's 5.4 burgers per dollar. Made with only half the normal bun, but twice as wide beef patties, these burgers look like if you put a little hat on a frisbee. How is this beef so cheap? Because it fell off a truck in India 4 months ago and we got our hands on it. For you, the hardworking American just trying to feed their family. If you hold it up to the light, it glistens with that certain je ne sais quoi that only old India truck beef can. We're not saying there's little bits of dog in it, but we are saying not to ask us if there are. So come on in today for that nice round number of 27 burgers for just $5, only for a limited time at Wendy's.
If we haven't desecrated collegiate sports enough, we're about to now. A related yet very separate story is the story concerning the, I believe, three, perhaps four class action lawsuits against the NCAA. The most notable one being House versus NCAA, which just achieved resolution last week with votes from the Power Five conferences agreeing to agree to a settlement that then basically approves a massive NCAA-led payout to athletes. Any NCAA Division I athlete, in theory, since the year 2016. I can think of one quasi-legitimate reason why some schools might be needing some capital injections after this agreement. I want to get into that. Do you want to highlight some of the backstory on all of the class action suits before we get into how this is going to affect schools, as always, disproportionately based on their size and the revenue that they bring in?
Happy to. This is a settlement involving three of the four major antitrust lawsuits against the NCAA, and that's an important distinction because that fourth one that is hanging on, and lawyers feel very strongly that this settlement is not in the best interest of college athletes. Settling the three essentially removes a sort of Damocles of sorts from over the heads of the NCAA and college sports. They recognize they had a bad hand heading into this. These cases were rolled together. They're quite strong. And they're settling for $2.7 billion in back pay to athletes who were exploited via this system in the past 10 years. And then moving forward, a big chunk of money set aside every year for any school that wants to offer it for compensating athletes more of the $1 billion that they help generate. And as we spoke about earlier, this is the separation of the haves from the have-nots. This is where it happens. It's this pool of, let's just say it's $30 million a year that schools are now able to offer athletes. And I promise you that the schools that are not offering it are not going to get the recruits that they were getting before, even in the imbalance of the world we have right now with NIL. So the NCAA, these schools are essentially choosing to settle this because I think they understand that what might come down the line is way worse. I've heard $20 billion might be what the cost would be if they continued to fight this fight. And what the plaintiffs, what the athletes get is compensation for recent college athletes who are no longer college athletes. And then moving forward, a brand new, we can debate how groundbreaking it is, but a brand new compensation structure for people competing in big time college sports.
As I understand it, the power conferences,
Sorry, I believe the Autonomy Five is it sounds like a boy band.
Which, what's the Pac-12 then? Is that Lance Bass? What does that make the Pac-12?
That's, oh man, I can't go there. I do believe the Autonomy Five does include the carcass of the Pac-12. The power conferences each had to vote to approve the settlement. As I understand it, they would get a $20 million, or as you guessed it, $30 million a year fund with which to effectively pay players.
It's less fund and more permissive benefit. So any school can offer it. So if you take a school like Boise or a school like Memphis, which is not in the Power Five right now, but wants to be, and has a strong enough brand that it is separated itself from the Troys and the South Alabamas and the Akrons and the Toledos of the world, they'll be able to offer this also. The big question is do they have can they, right? A lot of those athletic departments are already underwater financially.
So this is more if you have $20 million.
If you have it, you can give it.
Yeah. Which is separate from the $2.7 billion, $1.6 of which we understand will come straight from the NCAA.
Directly from the NCAA.
Which the NCAA would have just given to the schools anyway as rights payments, but now they're just saying we're going to shift that money and instead give it to you to pay players, and the remaining $1.1 billion of which is coming from a cocktail of the NCAA's reserves. I guess that's like the Mark Emmert Jet Fund, budget cuts, and quote catastrophic insurance. So the $20 million is just an.
Are we still talking about Red Lobster? What are we?
There's so many parallels. There's so many parallels today, Evan. It's all a metaphor.
If you think about it this way, like under the current rules, if Ohio State was like, we now are going to give $30 million every year to our athletes, the NCAA would be like, no, the heck you're not.
Right.
You're not allowed to do that.
Right.
Now the NCAA would be saying you are allowed to give up to this amount, and anyone who wants to do it can.
Right. In addition to paying the guy who played college basketball in 2018.
In addition to the $2.77 billion, which you're referencing, which is the back pay portion of the settlement. So much of the athlete activism world right now, or in the past 5 years, has been pushing this idea of a more open market. That what we have right now is an artificial cap on compensation for athletes, and that's unfair or unlawful, illegal. We're essentially doing that with the settlement. The cap is higher, albeit, but we are again putting in a artificial cap on what schools, what college athletes are allowed to be compensated by their, or allowed to be given by their university. And if I was the NCAA, if I was a big time college athletic director, president, commissioner, there's nothing that says that the minute this lawsuit settles that another antitrust suit doesn't come down the pipe saying that $30 million isn't enough. It's that we're still conspiring to suppress the earning potential of college athletes who should be making a lot more money. People should not think about this as a wiping the slate clean of problems with athlete compensation. In fact, I would argue that it runs the risk of just delaying the process even more. And honestly, that might just be the thing that they're hoping to do.
There is a distinction, though. I think several people are trying to paint this picture that it does, in fact, wipe the slate clean. Athletes would agree as they come into their freshman year of competition in future years in order to participate in these payments, right, to be added into the, quote, class of the current class action lawsuit, which is being settled, translated to which it means if they ever wanted to challenge the NCAA in a future lawsuit, they would have to opt out of the class, which allows them to share in the money. So that mechanism there makes it seem as if you are effectively wiping the slate clean, because even if you have future athletes that say, we do not want to elect to join this class action, which I like class action in retrospect, I guess, sort of, if they're like a 2027 player or something, if you have athletes that somehow do not want to join into that and therefore could challenge the NCAA, it might be harder to organize, there might be fewer of them. So there seems to be a narrative that's countervailing to the reality that you just laid out.
These lawsuits take years to work through. And because of that, the plaintiffs are former college athletes. And what they want is their bag. And sure, a lot of them want to reform the future. But you do have this weird system where the legal system takes so long that you have former college athletes that are always going to be the ones that are fighting this fight. And as a result, I'm not going to say they're being selfish. They're not. But as a result, the immediate self-interest in this is the $2.7 billion. It's not the whatever the cap is on future college football players or future college basketball players. It's what are we going to get? And that's what their lawyers are thinking also to a degree is my plaintiffs are that bucket. It's not the future. It's the back pay.
I, as a side note, can't get past the Pac-12 voting as the old Pac-12. What was that meeting like? Was it in person? Was it over Zoom?
I assume it was in Zoom, but if it was in person, it was very awkward. I promise you that.
We're taking care of family business after the divorce is what we're doing there.
Not a lot of small talk, I don't think, in the waiting room.
They click to like raise a hand in Zoom and that's how they voted? Was it just quick and businesslike?
People have their cameras off.
Absolutely. The one guy is unmuted but doesn't realize he's unmuted and he's just railing against everything else.
Counting his Big Ten money.
So
on the call.
Speaking of not the Big Ten, though, of other bigs like the Big East, for example, or the WCC or some of these other leagues. Now, those are two G5 leagues that have no football at all, right? In addition to things like Conference USA, the American Athletic Conference, the Sun Belt. These conferences also get disbursements from the NCAA. Annually,
there's way more of those schools, obviously, and they do share they do get a big chunk of the NCAA's distribution, and their financial tolerance is negative. It's zero.
Yeah, right?
Not a single one of those programs, and not even UConn, which is a dynastic men's basketball team at this point, and is the largest commercially viable women's basketball program in the country by a margin alongside South Carolina. Not even that school is underwater in money because its football team is not good and isn't in the conference. That's the reality.
Or you have schools with no football programs.
Yeah, these are schools that just are not in a financial situation to bear the brunt of this. And again, going back to this idea that all what we're seeing is finally a more firm separation of have and have nots. I don't think. In some ways, I want to like dial back the alarm for college sports fans who feel like everything is changing and everything's going to suck, because I don't think we're going to see that much initial change. I just don't. And there are people that love Patriot League football and Ivy League football, and would some FCS shift closer to that? Probably, but North Dakota State is still going to be a good football team that's going to beat up on a lot of its opponents and have cool rivalries with Montana and South Dakota State and if not James Madison, but a few other schools. Like, we're going to still see a lot of the cool stuff that we saw at different levels. There's just going to be a bigger professional thing happening up there with the Michigans and the Michigan States and the Ohio States and the Texases and the Alabamas and all them. But I don't think the sports fan, one of the things I always say, sports fans are incredibly resilient in the face of things they hate. And there's so many examples in the NBA or baseball of rule changes or things that fans hate, and they keep coming back and they adapt to the new reality. And 5 years later, they actually don't hate the new reality. My general feeling is that affinity for college football and college basketball is very strong right now.
Here's how I think about it. Imagine if college sports were a tangible consumer good, like a can of Pepsi or a drink that Pepsi made, one of the many drinks that Pepsi makes, right? I've drank Pepsi for years. I love it. But now Pepsi's made with different ingredients, or it's made in a different order. And so are all the other drinks. And some of the drinks haven't really changed. Some have changed a little. Some have changed a lot. The factory workers at Pepsi plants work in better working conditions and get paid a lot more than they used to, although actually many of them don't, but we're mostly just trying to make a gesture that demonstrates that we wish that they got paid more, but really like only the higher and middle managers get paid a lot more and the actual line workers don't really get paid more at all. But incoming line workers get paid huge initial signing bonuses for no real reason. And then some independently owned Pepsi production and distribution centers are shutting down while others are expanding and acquiring other production centers, and the trucks don't always know where to drive. So sometimes the Pepsi drinks that I am used to showing up in my grocery store don't always show up on the shelves. If I'm a casual Pepsi drinker, do I still want to drink Pepsi products after this? And I think maybe I don't care because I'm not really paying attention. A lot of these things happen behind the scenes. Most people are, in fact, casual. I think for the diehards, they're always going to be diehards, right? They don't care if Pepsi's changed. They're a Pepsi fan. They went to Pepsi U, right? It's in their blood. I think to the casuals, the true casuals, the people that walk past a game that someone else has on in their living room, I don't think those people are going to care because you don't have an emotional stake in what's going on. I think where it hits is the middle fan, more than a casual and less than a diehard, who know just enough to have been paying attention to see the changes wrought in a inequitable, yet it's in the name of equity, I would say inimical sort of way. I think if you do see some of that, it will be at that level of fan. But we do know that it's very different than the changes going on in college basketball. We wrote about this a lot for the college basketball competition that we ran. You know, it's you know, college basketball is more anonymized. There's more one and dones. There's, you know, the transfer portal is making things too hard to follow. This feels different. This feels like a separate issue. This feels more like the haves and have nots. I don't believe that the parity in college basketball has been affected. And maybe I'm naive about that. This feels more like something where we're separating classes while still under the guise of one class, where college basketball just seems like it's harder to follow because there's chaos.
I love that. By the way, the Pepsi analogy is felt like that scene in Good Will Hunting when he's rattling off the like cascading effects of why he doesn't want to work for the NSA. That felt like your version of it. I think that you want my hot take on college basketball.
I want nothing more.
I think the NCAA tournament is DOA at this point. I maybe it gets through the end of its current TV deal. I think there's 6 or 7 more years left, but the people in college sports that say that it is sacrosanct and it won't change, I think are lying. And that will be sad. I definitely think that is a bummer, but I don't see a world in which the NCAA tournament, where everyone that's currently the 300 whatever teams in Division I are all competing in a fairly equitable way to compete in this great thing in March. I don't see a way where that survives the money grabbing upheaval that we have in the next 4 or 5 years. I just don't.
When you say it's DOA, do you mean college basketball tournaments that determine who a champion are in general are DOA, or just our current iteration of the NCAA tournament?
I mean the current iteration. I mean the idea that in a given year, the start of the year, there's 350 teams that ostensibly can win an NCAA tournament. And that if you win the worst conference in the country, you are going to go up and play the best team in the country in this best of 68 or 128, whatever it is. And in this format, I don't think it's going to last very long. And this is the capitalist cynic in me, I think. I also think the very failed Super League structure in European soccer, every 5 years, they're going to try that until it succeeds. The democratic nature of sports, especially now when the people that are earning the vast majority of the money that swirls into those structures, those tournaments, those leagues, are forced to share it with others, spotlight money, et cetera. I think that all those things are going to disappear from sports in the next decade.
Why are we pursuing class action settlements, the realignment structure of college sports, determining the fate of who gets to compete for titles? Why are we doing any of this based on the premise of conferences at all?
I think it's a great question. I don't know. And going back to our private equity thing, there are conferences that want to raise money private equity wise. If I was an investor, I don't have faith in any of these things. Maybe the Big Ten and the SEC, but not even that. The ACC, if you told me, was gone in 5 years, it gets the Pac-12 treatment, I wouldn't be shocked. The Pac-12 looked safe 3 years ago. It's now gone. The Big 12, who knows? The idea of the conferences, I feel way more confident that Michigan and Ohio State and Penn State will be involved in whatever the highest tier of college football is in 10 years than I am that the Big 10 is going to be involved in the highest form of college football in 10 years. I think your conference question is a great one, because they have a very nice structure and play a very important role for other sports, but they're really starting to lose a lot of the value add in football and basketball.
Do the distributions going to the conferences from the class action settlement somehow slow down the implosion into a big super conference? Because on one hand, they run entirely antithetical to everyone's going to merge or fall away, because they are definitionally based on Power Five schools get this, non-Power Five schools do not. Or would there ever be a reasonable case to be made that instead of the top conferences splitting off, and forming a super conference, and that's what sort of does in the NCAA, that this new sort of punitive settlement kind of induces the smaller conferences to try to split off? We always talk about separation from the top, right? Well, it was the Power Five. Now three of the Power Five are dying, some slowly, some quickly, and it's really just going to be the Big Ten and SEC, and they're going to float away to the heavens, and everyone's in the dust. At what point do smaller conferences band together and say, hey, we're barely keeping the lights on here. This is dumb. Does separation come from the bottom ever?
It may. The value prop for conferences, I would argue, is stronger at the bottom, because they are still regional things that are holding on to regional rivalries, right?
I'm not saying do away with the conferences themselves. I'm saying retain that structure, but depart the NCAA, because they're getting less and less from the NCAA as the NCAA is first being sort of skewed by the Power Five, then the Power Two, then VC, which is only going to bubble up further to the highest of the highest. I'm not saying disband the conference structure. Yeah. I'm saying,
yeah, I see what you're saying now. Yeah, that's a good question. I have done very little reporting at Lehigh or Lafayette to get a sense of like how people at those Eco Leopards, yeah, how they view this world. My guess is that they like the structure and kind of unity of the NCAA and its rulemaking and its enforcement and all that. But I see it more happening at the top. And I talk to so many athletic directors who really do envision and want a future where their football team is separate from what they are. Spin it out, take investment, whatever it is, just operate football totally separately and keep a bunch of other schools and you're in the Big Ten, and you can keep regional rivalries in softball and baseball and soccer and volleyball, and just have football as a separate thing. And maybe it pays a licensing fee back to the university that can be the vehicle by which you still fund a lot of your other sports with football. But I see the breakaway happening at the top, just because they have outgrown the NCAA in a way that your smaller schools have not.
I see a sea of holding companies as you say that pops into my mind.
A lot of holdcos. A lot of
Connor Stallions Vacuum Cleaner LLC.com.
Yeah. How do we get into that business? How do we do the picks and shovels for the future holdcos of?
We gotta rope off the bottom 27 conferences, right? Just get them all together on a conference call, and then be the private equity fund that invests in them and say, hey, you know what? Go off and form your new NCAA, right?
Robin Capital Partners.
Robin Capital. You could fund it. I with what you're pulling in. I've seen you pick up the checks.
But look behind me. This is my entire apartment, Will.
Sitting in a magisterial gilded kingdom. You can't see it, but oh man. But overall, final word. You somewhat disagree with my take that some people will have a harder time enjoying college football in the mid to long term due to the changes, and instead you believe that it will still be an equally compelling product going forward.
I think it will be an equally compelling product. I think we're going to lose again some things that we really like and we will remain nostalgic for, but I think that the change in the product itself will happen slower than I think a lot of doomsday people are thinking. And again, it's exacerbating issues that already exist in a lot of ways. I don't think it's necessarily creating a ton of.
So there's no reason for people to not subscribe to Robin College Football and play in the 2024 Robin College Football Tournament.
No, I think in if anything, there's more reasons to. Well, I'm looking forward to competing in it. That's for sure.
You and dozens of other people. So
Spokane U, the Go Red Lobsters. Yeah.
God, the fighting landlocked lobsters of Spokane U.